Militants have attacked Iraq's largest oil refinery in the north of the country as government forces try to repel the rebel offensive. The Sunni insurgents are expanding their influence to the south of Iraq's second largest city of Mosul, which they took control of earlier this month. Iraqi government forces have intensified their counterattacks across the country. Fighting has raged in the northern city of Beji over control of the country's largest oil refinery. The facility produces 20% of Iraq's domestic supply of gasoline and other petroleum products. The Iraqi government says if the refinery falls to the extremists, people, particularly those in Kurdish autonomous areas in the north, could be drastically affected. Local media have reported that about 300 workers who had been trapped within the facility have been evacuated. Iraqi forces have retaken some areas of the northern city of Tal Afar, which had earlier fallen to the militants. Government forces are stepping up air
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Just goes to show you what happens when you take the nigger out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the nigger.
If I were to push the envelope just a little bit more, and I said that I hate fags because homosexuality is forbidden by God's law.
Praise God for AIDS.
And these Jewish puppets who want to sell our ideals just for ratings on some TV show, they will be the first ones to hang for their sins in the end. Their sins against God and y'all's sins against humanity.
With the crowd warmed up, one of the clan seniors tells the group how they plan to move in a new direction.
We're going to do something a little different for the next couple of years to try to get our men and women ready for the upcoming battle that we're about to take upon us. And this is something that no clan's ever done. We're going to start it. All our boys are finally coming back home from the military, which is good. And we're getting a lot more military members joining as we're going to start doing military training. Now that we got our Marines and the Army back, they're going to start showing us how to skin and how to survive off the land. We're going to try to move into another direction with the Lowell White Knights, and that is starting to arm train, hand-to-hand combat, and stuff like that just for the upcoming battle.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? What did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man come in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
What's on his Facebook page? So easy to set this up. Facebook that works with you know who so closely. Alex Jones, number one. Alan West, Representative Alan West. We'll do a document cam for TV viewers and I'll show folks this. And then it continues on here with Ron Paul, Rand Paul, about Jared Miller. And this links through to him saying he lives in Vegas. 3%er nation. Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's fault. But the media is not picking up on that. The media is demonizing yours truly. So, two Ronald Reagans. Oh, George Washington. My gosh, it's all his fault now.
Internet radio for smarter than original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, salutation and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under colonial, imperial, theological, racialist, homophobic, misogynist, neoclassist, neoliberal, neoliteral, neo-fascist, and anti-environmental oppression. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from AboriginalNewsWire.tumblr.com and AboriginalPress.wordpress.com and our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my executive producer and studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. After Las Vegas, after what happened here in Portlandia, It would be really silly to say that, I can't believe that this would happen here. Because wasn't Kip Kinkle from this region, if you remember him, Kip Kinkle? Remember him? Kip Kinkle. He was a young man who went berserk out here, flipped out, got into his grandfather's weapon stash. And, I believe he went to his high school and went berserk. Went postal, as they used to say. Remember that one? Remember how, the conservatives were using the two, I believe it was just two. It was really only two incidents that happened in postal services where, disgruntled employees took it out on their fellow workers. And I believe actually then, like a lot of these, nutcases, they do all this damage and then they take themselves out instead of taking themselves out to begin with. If Hitler has started off the way he ended, even though there's a lot of evidence now, even on the BBC, the BBC. Yeah, can you? Oh, no. Wait a minute. You're saying it was Sky News? Okay, well, Loopy's telling me of a Sky News, but we just watched something recently. They interviewed somebody. Yeah, you're right. It was Sky News. They interviewed someone who said that Hitler made it all the way down to Argentina. You know, why not? I mean, I was trying to tell everybody that was into Madonna, who was running to go see, you know, to make a big deal about her doing a Evita Perón, you know, because we all know Madonna believes she's really a Latina at heart. I know she's Italiana, but, you know, I know she believes she's Latina. I know. It is what it is, right? But, you know, she wants to play. She wanted to... Remember? Yeah, she wanted to play Frida Kahlo. It was like, you know, really? Are you serious? Really? You know, I mean, that's bad enough that Zoe Saldana. You know, I mean, it's nothing personal against Zoe Saldana. I mean, I like her as an actress. I mean, she's cool. You know, I mean, these vehicles now that actors and actresses are really left with in terms of everything going straight to video. You know, there's really nothing out there. It's every now and again you see a piece that's worth watching. But, you know, her playing Nina Simone is just in blackface is just ridiculous. When Nina Simone was the blackest woman in entertainment. You know. Well, let's just say she was one of the few black women who could actually keep her career being as political, you know, as she was, because it didn't work out like that for everybody. And I'm trying to remember homegirl's name right now, black actress. She really didn't make it. She could sing, she could dance. You saw her in some films in the 70s, and I'm not talking about Lola Falana, even though you can put her in this group. You know, she was quite political. But, you know, I mean, her managers didn't make much noise about that, right? Josephine Baker was political, overtly political. You know, one of the reasons black people have any respect internationally, really. Between her and Paul Robeson, I mean, nobody would give a fuck, and Malcolm X, nobody would give a fuck about us. Do you really think they talk about Dr. Martin Luther King? With all due respect, do you really think they talk about Dr. Martin Luther King in Africa? They mention him. But if you met, you know, they talk about Malcolm X more than they talk about him. They talk about the Black Panthers more than they talk about him. They talk about the late Geronimo Pratt more than they talk about him. They talk about the Reuben Ben Wahad more than they talk about him. Which is not a diss to the Reverend. It's just to point out who made more of an impact. They still speak about Marcus Garvey with tears in their eyes throughout the African diaspora. Do you dig what I'm saying? Canada Lee. I know a lot of you are too young to remember Canada Lee. He was an actor, a dignified actor, never took a demeaning role. Just like Bea Richards. Never took a demeaning role. Ever. At any time, under any circumstance. And I'm ashamed of myself. Because if my mother was here, she would smack the hell out of me right now. You know. You know, baby, I can't. Barbara McNair, thank you. Barbara McNair. Talk shit her entire fucking career. She ended up with nothing. You know, she ended up with absolutely fucking nothing. Just like Canada Lee, I just mentioned not too long ago. Canada Lee ended up shining shoes. He told people, he said, you know, my insisting on humanistic roles, my insisting on playing a black man that has some character. You know, I mean, for those of you who are into classic films, who are old enough to remember the film Lifeboat. Now, I can't remember every star there. I remember the faces, but I can't remember, you know, all of the names of these actors. You know, Life of Riley, whatever his name, William Bendix. Was that, well, you don't remember, right? You're too young. But, you know, in any case, he was the only ink spot on that whole goddamn production, right? Some cruise ship went down, and these people made it to a lifeboat, and no one else seemed to make it. It was separated from the other people who may have gotten off the ship. And, you know, they're trying to survive. They're exposed to the elements. William Bendix, right, who I mentioned earlier, he was drinking seawater. You know, I mean, things were desperate, you dig? But he was the only black man on this entire little rescue boat, this lifeboat. 6 or 7 other people. Can you imagine when they did have some little food, when they had whatever it was? Yeah, I believe they even had a little coffee and they somehow managed the way to brew this coffee. Do you know that he was serving them? It's like he was on the goddamn ship. They're all in the same fucking position. They're all fucked up. They may not see the next day. Tomorrow's not goddamn guaranteed. He was still the servant. He was still serving them. He was still giving them advice. He was the magic Negro helping these white people survive. And it's been so long, I can't even remember how the fuck it ended. But, you know, where am I going with this? Well, I started off with something else, but since now you broke my train of thought, okay, what am I really talking about? I just saw, Larry Pinkman, you know, Black Panther Party, Larry Pinkman. Yeah, I know I'm going on a tangent, but roll with it. For people in the Pacific Northwest, Pinkman is a bit of a legend. Black Panther Party, veteran. I mean, you know, I'm not going to take that from him. You know, he earned no stripes. He did. But see, I'm going to have to give the same criticism about him that I gave, you know, about the late Russell Means. Russell Means, well, and Immortal Technique. Let's throw it out there, right? These are the three examples that I'm pointing to. Now, we just see what the fuck happened with these white supremacist, you know, nutcases down in Las Vegas. Now, Immortal Technique has been on Alex Jones' show. Now, we're talking about Alex Jones now, who is completely fucking crazy. We have an episode when journalism fails. He is the main subject of that goddamn episode. Go review it. It's in the archives. Alex Jones is certifiably fucking crazy. And he's a pathological fucking liar. Listen to that broadcast. Okay? And listen to what other Patriot Movement people have to fucking say about him. We even got Mike Malloy giving commentary about this crazy son of a bitch. And fucking, and he is. He's just that. He's goddamn crazy. Now, I know there are people who are like, well, why don't you have him on the show? Why don't you just challenge him outright? Because like I said, I don't see the fucking point. He's going to come on and try to commandeer my goddamn show. And see, and what's going to end up happening is I'm just going to cut the fucking mic off. And then it's going to end up being nothing. And then he's going to go talk shit about me on his show. And I'm going to go talk shit about him on my show. And, you know, really, what's the point? I'm giving you an analysis now. This isn't a bit session. I'm giving you a fucking analysis. Alex Jones is certifiably fucking insane. He's a megalomaniac. He believes in his own fucking mythology. You know, don't think that he's complaining on his show about him being connected to this crazy ass clown couple that went and did all this goddamn damage in their personal war against the U.S. You know, their own fucking government that supports them, right? You know, all these fucking crazy ass white people going berserk. Hey man, you know, he is one of them. Now, Immortal Technique, I don't know what the fuck it is. He's got a love affair with weapons. They were sitting there oogling. You know, I thought they were looking at a woman on the goddamn table. They were sitting there looking at some 50mm goddamn, weapon of destruction. Right? There's no, you can't hunt with that kind of goddamn thing. There's no skeet shooting with 50mm, you dig? You know, that is a field-grade fucking weapon that belongs exactly there. In the fucking field for defense. There is no other use for anything like that unless you're into, you know, turning human beings into red mist. And if that's the case, you're simply a sick son of a bitch. And yeah, if Immortal Technique is about that, if he thinks that the entire thing can simply be solved with guns, then he's really misreading Che. And you can tell him I said that, alright? I'm not trying to start beef, I'm just trying to start a discussion here. You can tell him I said that, that he misread Che, that he misread Castro. If that's what he's looking at, that's the model that he's looking at. I thought Chavez got us past this. See, if you want to stick with Mugabe, yeah, you can deal with that, you know, right? You know, I mean, if you want to limit yourself that way. But Patrice Lumumba wasn't looking at it like this. And Mandela, you know. Yeah, we can really give an analysis on how, you know, everything had ended and how he went out here in this world in terms of his legacy after he was released. And you have to understand, too, the position that he was in, the position of South Africa, and the fact that Anglo-American and every other concern, basically, the white power structure here, was not going to let that fall. See, if you're going to talk about the Illuminati, talk about it in those terms. See, when you talk about, motherfucking white dudes sitting around in hoods and shit, in candlelit rooms in the fucking dark, with a rose on a goddamn table, right, Sub Rosa, sitting there with a fucking mitre or acceptor and shit, reading off some kind of fucking grimoire, go away from me. Get the fuck off my timeline. Don't have anything to do with this goddamn podcast anymore. Don't follow me on Twitter. Don't send me any more fucking email. Because you are also certifiably motherfucking insane. You're probably sitting in a fucking corner in the goddamn dark, right? With a fucking flashlight, eating gray goddamn spaghetti with a pair of fucking tweezers and shit, reading the fucking protocols of the elders of goddamn science, because you're insane. You're sick in the fucking mind. You need some goddamn help, really. And don't look to Jesus, because he passed a long time ago. He's buried in Kashmir next to a Muslim. Accept it, deal with it. This white supremacist fucking wonderland y'all are talking about never goddamn existed. And for those of you who are into Hans Jürger and the fucking Black Sun and Blavatsky and all that, all that other bullshit. All that other bullshit. Vadelsberg, Michael Aquino. The only thing Michael Aquino, the fucking Satanist, who was also a colonel in the motherfucking U.S., United States Army, okay, who was caught up in a fucking scandal at one point, right? A sex scandal and shit at the goddamn Presidio, San Francisco, if you want to believe that. Hey, the one thing he said in the goddamn 70s was true. Was that, I can't remember what essay of this was his. And like I said, even though I think he's kind of crazy with his fucking satanic shit and his admiration for the Third Reich, right? I mean, he's been to Wittelsburg Castle by his own admission and has performed black magic rituals in the basement of the Wittelsburg. If you're into the spirit of Longinus and all that type of shit, like I said, this is Alex Jones territory, David Icke territory. If you're into that, you go ahead and you follow that and you believe that if you choose to. It's a free world. But see, the thing, same thing with Hitler. He talked about certain things that were, really true about the Versailles Treaty. And this got him a lot of support from the blue collar people, but that's not what got him in. He was elected primarily from Krupp Steel and from members of the Bush family, members of the DuPont family. Go look up the business plot and Smedley Butler, Lieutenant General Marine Smedley Butler. And you look it up and you make up your own goddamn mind. It's a part of the congressional record. Look it the fuck up. Get up off your ass and do some fucking research. And ask yourself why Eric Cantor just lost this goddamn election here to a fucking complete, political psychopath. And you'll see what the fuck I'm talking about here. Pinckney is a Black Panther alumni. And here he is rolling with Alex Jones. Immortal Technique can pull the ear of every young person in America and in the Latin speaking world, because he's a South American Indian. You dig what I'm saying? He is proud of his Black Indian roots. On that point, he and I are on the same page. His fucking sitting on the show with Alex Jones, that's suspect. I'm not talking about him as an individual, I'm talking about politically. That's suspect. This is somebody who said that the Trayvon Martin case was a hoax, that it never happened. There are people who follow Alex Jones. We have the links. Follow my timeline, The Angry Indian, on Twitter, who are out here pushing the idea that Trayvon Martin never existed. That this whole thing never happened. That Zimmerman never shot anybody. That nothing ever happened. That this was just another plot like Sandy Hook to take their guns. Even though Blackwater did that during Katrina, but they took the guns of black people. So, hey, nobody really cares. Right, because Democracy Now! Talked about not even just the Danziger Bridge case. Look that up through the Democracy Now! Archives at democracynow.org.
But check out how they had on file people admitting to having shot black people. One cat saying that he got his wings, that he was a southerner. That he was now a true southerner because he was a northern transplant, that he earned his wings during Katrina. democracynow.org. You go check it out. So, you know, black man and woman, do you still not realize that the neo-Nazis are making a push? They're winning elections in Europe. You know, they're pushing in Uganda. You know, they're pushing in South America, right? Colombia. You know, not Venezuela. Venezuela's trying to hold its own. What happened in Honduras? What happened under the Obama administration in Honduras? Yeah, that's what I thought. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Old color guy down in Mississippi, you know, down there they call you nigger. So this nigger, he kissed a white bro. So the white man said, nigger, so you know you kiss my wife, don't you? Yes, sir, boss. So you know you kiss Miss Ann, you know your ass gonna be hung, don't you? Yes, sir, boss. Took the nigger out in the woods, gonna hang him, see. So said, nigger, so you been with us a long time, and say we're gonna give you a break. We're going to let you pick out the tree you want to be hung on. Nigga running around there trying to find his tree to be hung on. All day long, like to walk them white folks to death, trying to find his tree to be hung on. So pretty soon, he came to a little bush, you know. He said, hey, mom. He said, yeah, nigga. Say, this the tree, I found it. Posse come ran up there, said, now, nigga, you know we can't hang your big black ass on that little bush. He said, yeah, sir, boss. He said, I know it. He said, but I'll wait till they grow up if it's all right with you.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year or whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African American.
Yeah, I was driving in today and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at headonradionetwork.com. There's a listen live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Annie from Au Revoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Right now, whether you're drinking at home in quantity or driving to a local AA meeting because this special is driving you to drink, either way, you're listening to
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
What he didn't explain or give an answer to was the question I asked him 12 months ago. Would he explain to the House the differences between the Al-Qaeda we're supporting in some countries and the Al-Qaeda we're considering a threat to life as we know it in other places? We are supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. We've given them a very substantial sum of British taxpayers' money, even more in the way of military aid and logistics and training and the support of special forces. But when those very same Al-Qaeda crossed the border into Iraq, well, it's the end of life as we know it, and we must bomb them. This simply, as a matter of simple logic, cannot be squared.
So what do you make of Mr. Cameron's raising of worries that Britain needs to be prepared for ISIS insurgents waging a war in favour of an Islamic caliphate back here in Britain eventually?
I told you so. More importantly, I told him so. I told him that these people that you're encouraging in Syria will one day stalk the streets of our own country. That's why I described Britain's policy in Syria as close to insanity. I told William Hague, you've been wrong many times before. In fact, you've been wrong most of your life, but you've never been insane before. This policy of encouraging jihadism in Syria is close to literal insanity.
What do you think Mr. Cameron and Mr. Hague should be doing, if anything, about Iraq?
We cannot intervene in the conflict in Iraq, even though that conflict may now lead to the physical separation of the country. This ISIS formation cannot possibly conquer Baghdad, still less conquer the south of the country. So, de facto, Iraq no longer exists. It's at least three countries. It is the Kurdish entity, the ISIS-controlled Sunni heartlands, and the Shiite-controlled capital and south. And that will be pregnant with many terrifying problems for now and for many decades to come.
But, I mean, some people can see the longer-term prospect of Britain recanting in some areas in its foreign policy, of now cozying up potentially to Iran, and some have even suggested perhaps reawakening their relationship with Bashar al-Assad because he might be a bulwark against ISIS.
Well, they ought to relate to the government in Syria in an entirely different way. To the one they are. They ought to be supporting the Syrian government's mortal struggle against these al-Qaeda elements. They must dispose of a trick they learned in the 1980s in Afghanistan, which has led to so much trouble. You see, your enemy's enemy isn't always your friend. Sometimes your enemy's enemy is worse than your enemy. And sometimes it's right to collaborate with your enemy against your enemy's enemy.
Do you see the shadow of the former Labour Party leader and Prime Minister Tony Blair in any of the events happening today in Iraq?
He was hovering in the rafters in the chamber today, not least when the very august figure of the father of the house, Sir Peter Tapsell, himself a former soldier in the 1950s and 60s, calling for Mr. Blair's impeachment.
But for what crime?
Oh, the crime of making aggressive war against Iraq, misleading the British Parliament and public, misleading Her Majesty the Queen.
Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Today on Taking Aim, the world's crisis is the crisis of imperialism. Just a few days ago, on the Portuguese island of Terceira, in the Azores, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, President Bush traveled 2,300 miles to meet with Prime Minister Blair of England and Prime Minister José María Aznar of Spain, who each traveled 1,000 miles. They sat around a table for barely an hour. What were they doing in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean for basically a photo opportunity? They couldn't meet in any of the capitals of their respective three countries without a full-scale military mobilization. Why? They had to be inaccessible to the people of their own countries in order to avoid the mass protests like the 1 million people who marched in the Spanish capital the day before their meeting, or the 1 million people marching throughout the United States. Ralph?
In the Financial Times, Maya, on the 12th of March, an instructive article by George Soros. The title of it is Bush's Inflated Sense of Supremacy. And Soros, who is a spokesperson for capital, and particularly the fictive capital of its speculative phase, made the following comments in his article. There is a parallel between this Bush administration's pursuit of American supremacy and the boom-bust process and the bubble in the stock market. And these bubbles, he writes, do not grow out of thin air. They have a solid basis in reality. But those bubbles are related to the attempt to establish a dominant position of the United States. The pursuit, he writes, of this supremacy is based upon a misconception. Reality may reinforce the misconception, but eventually the gap between reality and this false understanding becomes unsustainable. And in its self-enforcing phase, the misconception represented by the Bush administration's pursuit of supremacy may be tested and even reinforced, but the gap widens, and the gap leads to an eventual reversal, and the later it comes, the more devastating the consequences, writes George Soros in the Financial Times. The crisis of imperialism is the crisis of humanity. It is driving us into perpetual war. It is preparing us for an assault upon our very survival across national frontiers. And it is the people of this world who must come to terms with this imperialist order.
On Saturday, March 15th, when Tony Blair held an emergency war cabinet meeting, he had to come face the fact that a good deal of the Labour Party was disaffected from his policies. In fact, should the United Nations not pass a second resolution, and that seems an inevitable fact, Robin Cook, the leader of the House of Commons, has announced that Robin Cook would resign as leader of the House of Commons, and Tony Blair will find himself with being the head of a Labour Party that is in complete disarray and does not support his policies. And what you have is the U.S. bombers have not only been bombing the missile installations in Iraq, but they are now going after all the radar systems with B-1 bombers knocking them out day after day. The war is on. It is only a matter of moments. The United States is going to go it alone. Ralph?
Shock and awe, writes William Arkin. Shock and awe in the Los Angeles Times of the 17th of March. Shock and awe, he writes, is not enough. 3,000 missiles in 48 hours, more than in the entire period of the Gulf War, are not sufficient, he writes. They cannot accomplish the task. What is the task? The devastation of Iraq. What are the consequences? According to the United Nations estimates, 14 million children in starvation. And 60% of the population are children under the age of 11. What will be the implementation of this? The devastation of the water system, the devastation of the electrical system, the elimination of sewage and of potable water across Iraq. Just the beginning. Just the beginning. And indeed, when we look at the actual realities that define the power of the United States versus the desperately impoverished country of Iraq, and there's discussion of weapons of mass destruction. How many nuclear warheads does Iraq have? Zero. How many nuclear warheads does the United States have? 20,000. How many nuclear warheads does Israel acknowledge to have? Over 400. This is the reality on the ground. This is a country that has been devastated by sanctions implemented by the United Nations, rendered devastated and destroyed, and victimized for its riches and its oil.
Rebuilding America's defenses, the strategy, the forces, and the resources for a new century. The war in Iraq is the opening note for an entire strategy of permanent war that was the basis of the report for the Project for the New American Century that was released September 2000, the Project for the New American Century, founded by William Kristol, the neoconservative editor of Rupert Murdoch's Weekly Standard, who had been the top aide to Dan Quayle, and is the son of Irving Kristol, called the godfather of neoconservatism. And the other co-founder of PNAC is Robert Kagan, who is the son of Donald Kagan, a professor at Yale, and is very close to the Likud, and particularly Benjamin Netanyahu, and none other than Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, people who set the defense policy. Now, the participants of this incredible PNAC document, which is available, the full 90 pages, on the internet, it's instructive to look at who put together this document, the document that has been adopted line by line by the Bush administration. In fact, one of the members of the project participants was Dov Zakim, who is now the Undersecretary of Defense, the controller for the Department of Defense. And under the Reagan administration, he was in charge of defense planning for nuclear war and was part of the Vulcans. The Vulcans were the advisory group for President Bush when he was running his campaign for the presidency. The Vulcans dealt with setting the Bush policy for international affairs. Now, Paul Wolfowitz, who is the Undersecretary of Defense, was also part of this planning for the Rebuilding America's Defenses, as well as I. Lewis Libby and Adam Schulsky of the RAND Corporation, who is the co-author of many books with none other than Zalmay Khalilzad, who has been assigned by the Bush administration to deal with the Iraqi National Congress. And then we have Elliot Cohn, who is on the policy planning staff for the Secretary of Defense and wrote the Gulf War Air Power Survey. Now, the also Stephen Cambone, who right now is the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. He was appointed by President Bush. So we have here the entire defense apparatus writing in the year 2000 what has become U.S. policy. The person who actually authored it, Thomas Donnelly, who put together all the information from these people who are now the heart of the Department of Defense, is Thomas Donnelly. He is now the Director of Strategic Communications at Lockheed Martin, and at the time was part of the Project for the New American Century. Incredible. The people who are shaping the policy tied to the military-industrial complex, because that is what this is all about. Profits as well as hegemony over the world.
There's a particular intersection, as we've discussed over a substantial period of time, and as the Nation article by Jason Vest that we cite so frequently on September 2nd of last year, called The Men from JINSA and the CSP, it establishes the intersection between the policies of the Likud of the Israeli military-industrial complex and those of American imperialism at its center. Classically and traditionally, the Israeli state, the colonial settler state, was funded between $10 and $14 billion a year as a cat's paw, as an instrument for advancing imperial policy and for destabilizing the struggle of Arab peoples against colonialism, against imperial control of their natural resources, for ensnaring and enticing weakened Arab regimes into conflict that would allow more territory to be seized, to undermine governments, to fragment the states. And indeed, at the end of the 70s, the Mossad had evolved a plan calling for the fragmentation of each Arab nation and each Middle Eastern country in its turn. It is that which the neoconservatives, the hawks, began to integrate with imperial policy itself. A significant sector of American imperialism has been involved with the elites in the Arab world, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, the feudal oligarchies of the Gulf states, the middlemen, the people who are the comprador elements who take their cut while the oil riches are siphoned off and flight capital outside the country. But the Israeli project has been one of undermining the regimes themselves Breaking up those countries adds seriatim, and it is that scenario which has now been integrated with the aims of imperialism, which is why the men from Jinsa and the CSP, the Chicken Hawks, the neoconservatives of the Likud, are at the center of American policy. And as Jason Vest outlined it in a very important article, we cannot cite it too frequently, and as he describes, the grand strategy for the Middle East will concentrate on, quote, Iraq as the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia as the strategic pivot, and Egypt as the prize. And they cite Michael Ledeen, who is leading the charge for regime change in Iraq and in Iran itself, while his old comrades Andrew Marshall and Harold Rode in the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment locate ways to re-engineer the Iranian and Saudi states themselves and their decomposition.
On page 51 of this document to which I was referring, Rebuilding America's Defenses, they state explicitly, a number of regimes are deeply hostile to America, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, Libya, and Syria. And they go on to say that they're already have or are developing ballistic missiles that could threaten U.S. allies and forces abroad. In other words, they are creating the axis of evil that was adopted by President Bush, the stage-by-stage scenario for permanent war based on fabrication of evidence. Now, what's important to note in that entire premise of Rebuilding America's Defenses, which, as I mentioned, is really a collaboration of the war machine, the manufacturers, Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop Grumman, all the defense manufacturers and their agents within the Department of Defense, the war machine, they state, whether established in permanent bases or on rotational deployments, the operation of U.S. and allied forces abroad provide the first line of defense of what may be described as, quote, the American security perimeter. American security perimeter. Now, this is an important concept to note because what they are talking about is extending permanent bases throughout the world, particularly in Asia, in South Asia, because as they note here in the very beginning of this chapter 3, repositioning today's force, they've already established the Balkans as a protectorate. They call it that, a protectorate. It is a permanent fact of life, and they've already accepted the premise of a permanent U.S. presence in the Gulf. We have spoken again and again about the importance of establishing military bases throughout Iraq, as they have done in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the other Emirates. And here they are talking about permanent bases in the Gulf, permanent bases throughout Europe. They're now establishing bigger bases in Hungary, for instance, and the Balkans as a protectorate, permanent occupation. And what their next move is into Asia. Two weeks ago, we said from Baghdad to Beijing, and this document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, is a step-by-step outline of how they are going to do it.
Maya, I remember so vividly during the 1960s, in fact during the year 1967 when I spent 7 months in Bolivia, Che Guevara had outlined a strategy for the oppressed. Two, three or more Vietnams, he spoke of, spread imperialism thin. Imperialism is meeting the challenge of the peoples of the world by an overt, explicit global domination that requires intervention and military devastation everywhere and in several places simultaneously. Here we have ABC News on March 10th with a feature story on the ABC television news called The Plan. The neoconservatives' 1998 memos were a blueprint for the Iraq War, is the subheading. The Project for the New American Century, founded in 1997, with the prominent presence of three high-level Republican former officials who were sitting through the Democratic presidency of Bill Clinton, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Paul Wolfowitz. The group preparing for the removal of Saddam Hussein's regime from power and a shift towards a U.S. policy in the Middle East that would include the use of force in every country in that region, the ABC report continues. And it states the report just before the 2000 election that would bring Bush to power predicted that this shift would come about slowly unless they were able to find a catalyst, what was called, quote, a catastrophic and catalyzing event. A new Pearl Harbor is what we require, unquote. A new Pearl Harbor is what we require. The project for the new American century, looking for the casus belli, looking for the pretext, contriving the category of terror as the rationale for a long-standing plan for imperial dominance on a permanent and global scale. That, indeed, is what the 15 people, the 18 people, who signed the letter of demand, as it's described by ABC News, of the Project for the New American Century, 10 of whom are now the key figures in the Bush administration, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, John Bolton, Undersecretary of State for Disarmament, Zalmay Khalilzad, who Maya has described, the linchpin figure at the Rand Corporation, William Kristol of the Weekly Standard Magazine, and Richard Pearl, Chairman of the Defense Science Board and the Committee on the Present Danger. This is the group. This is the axis. This is the center of imperial design today, linked to the Likud of the Israeli state. And as the American Free Press itself, in its headline story, described it, America Pearl Harbored. The fanatical war hawks have drafted the blueprint for a bloody U.S. world domination, and it was prepared years ago. These are not, I emphasize, this is the mainstream of American journalism and its conservative edge. The American Free Press, no less than ABC, identifying what is taking place here. In the article by Christopher Boland, billions of dollars to be added to defense spending, but the first step of this group's long-term plan to transform the U.S. military into a global army, enforcing a terroristic and bloody Pax Americana around the world, with pretext, with lies, with manipulation, with domination, and with the elimination of our liberties. This is the neoconservative Washington-based organization, the article continues, known as the Project for the New American Century, funded by three foundations closely tied to Persian Gulf oil and weapons and defense industries that have drafted this war plan for U.S. global domination through military power. And the article details the PNEC and its founding by what it calls the well-known Zionist neoconservatives linked to the Likud, and it cites Robert Kagan, it cites William Kristol, it spells out the role of Dick Cheney, of Donald Rumsfeld, of Jeb Bush, of Paul Wolfowitz, and their statement of principles of the Project for the New American Century on June 3rd, 1997.
What is important to realize is, I said before, with the concept of the Balkans as a protectorate and as the plans for the long-term occupation of Iraq are revealed in the press, and as we've been doing on Taking Aim over the past months.
18 months.
The long-term occupation under the auspices of the Pentagon, with General Tommy Franks as the military commander. And it was revealed that the United States plans to take control of all the apparatus of the functioning of life in Iraq and to actually pay the salaries of the bureaucrats. Now, when asked how can there be $100 million to pay for the salaries in Iraq, while, for instance, in San Francisco, they sent out 700 layoff notices to the teachers and the librarians, and in New York there are threats to shut down many libraries, and you have in the city of Oakland, where one-third of the teachers and the librarians and the social workers in the schools got potential layoff notices, and throughout California you have situations such as this, and you have this throughout New York. How is it that the United States takes responsibility for Iraq's salaries. Now, here we have the government saying, oh, we're not going to pay for it. The Iraqis are going to pay for it, when we know full well that is the people of the United States who pay for it, and also the peoples of Iraq being imposed with debt. Now, over the past months, we've been referring to the fact that in Iraq, people at this point have been driven to the point through the 12 years of sanctions, to the point where they're living on 30 cents a day. Actually, it turns out that government employees in Iraq are getting $5 a month. It's even worse now. That's 17 cents a day. Ralph?
Richard Pearl's new pal, 6 degrees of Adnan Khashoggi, writes Timothy Noah in an important article about the forthcoming critical issue of by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine for March 17th on the relationship between Richard Pearl and the chairman of the Defense Policy Board and none other than Adnan Khashoggi. And as Richard, as Seymour Hersh and indeed Timothy Noah point out, Adnan Khashoggi is connected to every central maneuver by banks and the clandestine worlds of the Oliver Norths and the Central Intelligence Agency and the BCCI and the covert operations and the drug smuggling and the laundering of money. Every single element of those, from BCCI to the Nugan Hand Bank of Australia, Khashoggi has been a central figure in the funding of Harkin Energy, in the emergence of the Carlyle Group, in the links between the Saudi elite, including the family of Osama bin Laden and the Bush father and son. Khashoggi has been a linchpin figure from the Markridge Parton, from WedTech, and as Timothy Noah cites, from BCCI, from the Marcos Philippine kleptocracy to the Sinfuels fiasco. It is Khashoggi that has been linked to the rulers in their corrupt laundering of funds and their preparation of seizure of power in country after country. And now we find in the article that has been featured in The New Yorker that Richard Pearl, in his capacity as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, has a long-standing commercial relationship with none other than Adnan Khashoggi and his shadow world of laundered funds, drug smuggling, and covert operations. Trireme's business potential, Trireme being the clandestine company of none other than Richard Pearl, is one in which Khashoggi has been a key player. And as Khashoggi saw it, if there's no war in Iraq, well, then billions of dollars will not be made. You Americans blind yourselves, Khashoggi states, with your democratic morality. But what are we all but influence peddlers for profit?
Ralph, the Seymour Hersh New Yorker article is out, and Richard Pearl responded immediately by suing Seymour Hersh for defamation, but the New Yorker is backing up Hersh. The New Yorker says they have done a lot of fact-checking. They went through this article four times, and they stand behind the facts. You can see it either at the New Yorker or at www.truthout.org.
The record of BCCI money laundering, the record of the drug smuggling and the arms dealing that Pearl has been linked to through Khashoggi and that Seymour Hersh exposes is so overwhelmingly documented, Pearl is going to have a wonderful time in court addressing the documents on record.
Now, let's look at Pearl's company, Trireme, which is, by the way, a venture capitalist firm. It's Pearl, and another investor is Gerald Hillman. Now, among the primary investors of this company,
which is it's Trireme.
Oh, Trireme, sorry. It's $20 million from Boeing, the connection between the defense companies and Richard Pearl. Now, Richard Pearl has a non-paying job as head of the Defense Policy Board. Non-paying, except that Richard Pearl is getting many perks, such as the $20 million investment from Boeing. Now, he was meeting with Khashoggi and also an Iraqi who was a Saudi industrialist who had been born in Iraq, Harb Saleh al-Zuhair. They were meeting in France, and Khashoggi, al-Zuhair, and also the Saudis admit that Pearl and Hillman have been trying to get Saudi investment in Pearl's company. And what is the basis of Pearl's company, this venture capitalist company? It has to do with homeland security and goods and services that deal with the fear of terrorism. The very notion that Pearl is creating and has been the linchpin of his policy since the 1970s.
Since indeed the category of terror was designated as the replacement pretext for massive rearmament and then for imperial forward design, the substitute for the menace of the defunct Soviet Union was the category of terror. The conferences in Tel Aviv, the conferences in Washington with Netanyahu and George Shultz and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Libyan Feith, the entire crew. Just the beginning, says the American Prospect on April 1st, its issue of April 1st, 2003. Iraq is the opening salvo in the war to remake the world. The United States is going to war against Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein from power, but it is a far greater venture than that. It is a signal event, writes Robert Dreyfus, to create cataclysmic shockwaves throughout the region and around the world and to usher in a new era of American imperial power intended to be invincible. I think we are going to fight a regional war, said Michael Ledeen, U.S. national security official and a key strategist in the flock of neoconservative hawks, many of whom have taken up the central perches inside the U.S. government, writes Richard Dreyfus. The war against Iraq is but the little beginning. Ledeen states that the logic of the global war will drive the United States to confront an expanding network of enemies in the region. The moment we land in Iraq, we're going to face the whole network, and the next steps are clear, says Ledeen. Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Libya, Yemen, and Somalia are slated for U.S. military action. To these states, writes Richard Dreyfus, cabal ringleader Richard Pearl, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, chairman of the Defense Policy Board, the key and influential Pentagon advisor, is quoted as follows. We deliver a short message, he quotes Richard Pearl as saying, a two-word message, you're next, quote unquote.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The World's Crisis is the Crisis of Imperialism. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet, www.wbai.org. You can reach us at 212-209-2953. We have a website now, www.wbaifree.org/taking aim. And there's an archive of our programs of the past few months on the website. You can also contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell.net or 212-209-2953. We'd love to hear from you. The world's crisis is the crisis of imperialism.
And there is not a newspaper in any part of this planet that has failed to document what is afoot. Here is the Daily Times in Karachi in Pakistan. Iran is next in U.S. sights after Iraq, Tehran. The United States is following an anticipated offensive against Iraq with its preparation for the follow-up war in Iran. The article details the plans, which are not just drawing board plans, but operational plans for pursuing Iran after Iraq, outlined in the Pakistani Daily Times on March 17th of this year. And the Minneapolis Star Tribune, North Korea. The United States is pushing a nuclear situation and pressing North Korea into a tight corner. The Star Tribune states that even as they disavow the intent of a war with Korea, the Pentagon, and the Rumsfeld and Cheney and Pearl strategists are preparing for a war that may indeed involve nuclear weapons on the part of the United States in Korea. Korea is next, says the Minneapolis Star Tribune, even as the Daily Times in Karachi outlines Iran as the target of following choice.
Ralph, I'd like to go back to rebuilding America's defenses, the PNAC outline of this strategy that you're saying, you're showing has been revealed and coming to the fore in newspapers throughout the world. It talks about developing deeper alliances with Australia, Indonesia, and Malaysia. And people may recall that the Australians have agreed to commit forces, and it's created enormous anti-war mobilizations in Australia, putting pressure on the Australian governments to not participate in a coalition, the fig leaf of coalition that the U.S. has assembled. Now, when they talk about this, they're talking about controlling key sea lines of communication. Notice this, control of key sea lines of communication. And that's why they want forces throughout Southeast Asia. They say it's to maintain regional stability, but it's transparent in these documents. It is to control the resources in the very way that the traditional empires, the British Empire with its navy, controlled the seas and thus controlled the resources long ago. So they talk about an increased naval presence in Southeast Asia and also permanent bases, pre-positioning material. Throughout the press, we've heard for years about the pre-positioning of material throughout the Gulf, the tanks, the airplanes, the bombs. And that is what they're talking about in every corner of the world today. Pre-positioning material, large permanent bases. They say that it's a deficiency of the U.S. military, that it relies on reservists. As you know, there's been large call-up of reserves to the Gulf. And what they say is that we've got to go back to a very large permanent military, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and the Army, the infantry. And as along with that, the weaponry, including control of space. The document is really transparent that of using space, not only for space communications as the world is ringed with satellites, but actually having missile defense forces and using space to launch missile attacks.
Maya, in the Manchester Times in Great Britain on March 12th, there is a significant article. The headline is, thousands of U.S. fatalities are expected in Iraq. And the article says that experts anticipate that exposure to weapons of mass destruction will result in tens of thousands of U.S. military dead. It's an instructive article because it becomes increasingly apparent that the weapons of mass destruction, which is the leitmotif of the Bush regime as a rationale for its invasion of Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction are those of the United States itself.
Ralph, I'm glad you brought that up at this point, because on Saturday, March 15th, Doug Roque, who had been the U.S. Army health physicist, who had been ordered by the Pentagon, and in particular General Norman Schwarzkopf, to clean up the depleted uranium to analyze it in the Gulf. And he was the former Department of the Army and Department of Defense DU project director. He came out with an impassioned statement, calling the use of depleted uranium in the tanks and in the missiles and in the armor-penetrating projectiles that are used in Iraq, quote, a crime against God and humanity. In bold letters, he said, DU health and environmental hazard warnings were originated by Army scientists who studied DU before the war, and he goes back even to the Manhattan Project in 1943, and scientists then suggested that uranium be used as air, water, and terrain contaminant. That is, going back to October 30th, 1943, U.S. military scientists were contemplating using radioactivity as a weapon of war.
Maya, Senator Robert Byrd, in the United States Senate on the 12th of March, interrogated Donald Rumsfeld in a story that has been actually reported in Newsweek, although not widely elsewhere. And in his interrogation of Donald Rumsfeld, Senator Robert Byrd said the following. Baghdad, 1983. United States intelligence begins to supply Saddam Hussein with critical weapons and with satellite coordination, observing and detailing uranium deployment. Indeed, the United States arranges for tanks and for all military hardware to be shipped to Iraq. American tanks are sent to Egypt and the Egyptian tanks are sent to Iraq. The Pentagon key figure in this Reagan administration policy is Donald Rumsfeld. Richard Byrd states, the Department export control documents obtained show that the shopping list for Saddam Hussein, overseen by Donald Rumsfeld, includes chemical weapons, biological weapons, the prototype of nuclear weapons, bacteria, fungi, and I'm quoting, protozoa, bacteria cultures to be used for biological weapons under the American direction, including anthrax. Rumsfeld approving the shipment of 1.5 million atropine injectors to Saddam Hussein by the United States. The imagery that Saddam Hussein is using chemical weapons against Iranian troops, says Robert Byrd, reflects the fact that Donald Rumsfeld was overseeing a policy in which mustard gas, sarin, Tabin, and VX in 1988 were being provided by the Reagan administration under Donald Rumsfeld to the regime of Saddam Hussein to be used against Iranian troops and to be used against its own population.
Ralph, there's been false evidence presented by Colin Powell at the United Nations, false evidence repeated over and over again by President Bush, whether it's in the State of the Union address or before the United Nations or before West Point in developing his strategy for world domination with the preemptive attacks. Yet, the Department of Navy, the U.S. Marine Corps Division of the Department of the Navy, the Marine Corps Combat Development Command, issued a report December 10th, 1990. Now, this is the official report of the Marine Corps on the eve of the Gulf War, first Gulf War. And it was an analysis of the Iraqi army and the tactics of the Iraqi army in the war between Iraq and Iran that was stimulated by the United States. And it was prepared by Dr. Stephen Pelletier and Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Johnson II of the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College. And I mention it because this is the official position of the Marine Corps, and it has never, ever been discredited. In this report, Dr. Pelletier and Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Johnson state explicitly that blood agents were allegedly responsible for the most infamous use of chemicals in the war, the killing of the Kurds at Halabja. Since the Iraqis have no history of using these agents and the Iranians do, we conclude that the Iranians perpetuated this attack. It is also worth noting that lethal concentrations of cyanogen are difficult to obtain over an area target. Thus, the reports of 5,000 Kurds dead in Halabja are suspect. They state in another part, we find no evidence whatsoever that the Iraqis have ever employed blood gases such as cyanogen chloride or hydrogen cyanide. False evidence repeated and repeated over and again by Secretary of State Colin Powell and President Bush as the basis for this slaughter of the Iraqi people.
And actually, Maya, what we're really looking at here are the unfoldings and the delineation of imperialism's policies from the inception. As we have so often described, Saddam Hussein's government is the result of a Central Intelligence Agency counter-revolutionary overthrow of Abdul-Karim Qasim, who is the leader of the Iraqi Revolution of 1958 that nationalized oil and restricted oil companies to 0.1% of Iraq. In 1953, when Mossadegh in Iran had nationalized oil, the Central Intelligence Agency imposed the Shah in a coup, and the Israeli Mossad established that deadly secret police, the Savak. When Abdul Karim Qasim was murdered by the Central Intelligence Agency agent, one Saddam Hussein, the CIA directed the creation of the Palace of the Damned under the torture of Saddam Hussein, the CIA's man in Baghdad for 27 years. The constant policy of imperialism is to establish the most ruthless and brutal counter-revolutionary cabal regimes to do their bidding, and then to hang these people, these Noriegas and Saddam Husseins, out to dry when they want to provide a boogeyman to provide the rationale for the next imperial adventure. The St. Petersburg Times, on March 16th, in an instructive article called "It's Not Iraq, It Is Anniston, Alabama," the St. Petersburg Times says, "The cache of chemical weapons in Anniston, Alabama, includes 873,020 pounds of sarin, 1,657,480 pounds of VX nerve agent, 1,976,000 pounds of mustard gas, enough to kill and incapacitate tens of millions of people across the planet. They told William Hutchings he would have to have his building by now. But when Hutchings and 550 students and teachers and staff in the school practice what to do if there's an explosion in the Army Depot 5 miles away, they pile into a converted music room." And what this article is describing is the center of the United States weapons of mass destruction, millions upon millions of nerve gas and other deadly chemical and biological agents that the U.S. is preparing to use and which supplies to its client states whenever it deems it appropriate. The source of the weapons of mass destruction, the directors of the murderous agents that are imposed upon regimes and used always in a manner to sustain imperial control and to devastate the peoples of the victim countries concerned. The St. Petersburg Times, "It is not Iraq, it is Anniston, Alabama." And there is a long-standing, well-established history of the use of weapons of mass destruction, the terrible use of chemical and biological agents that the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina documented, gases that exploded the pupil of the eye. I don't speak here just of the Agent Orange, which has poisoned the aquifer and the soil and has resulted in generations, 45 and 50 years of generations of deformed births and of endemic disease across Indochina. But in every theater of combat that imperialism has worked its way, these weapons of mass destruction have characterized their predations upon the populations they seek to subjugate.
Yes, Ralph. Weapons of mass destruction. An important article appeared in Al Aram on March 5th. In the February 27th to March 5th issue, Traces of Poison, an article by Salman Abusita. And he discusses documents that recently were released by the International Committee of the Red Cross. documents about the use of biological terrorism by the Zionists in Palestine in their move to destroy the indigenous Palestinian population and so take over and displace the Palestinians in the Middle East.
The series of massacres, Maya, from one end of Palestine to the other in the 6 months preceding the formal establishment of the Israeli state were punctuated, as the United Nations and the International Committee of the Red Cross have now documented, by the use of typhus and germ warfare and cholera germ warfare. The city of Acre's water supply was willfully and deliberately contaminated with typhus and cholera germs, which created a devastating epidemic. The typhoid poisoning that afflicted the people of Acre was the result of deliberate Zionist introduction of this agent in the aqueduct feeding Acre, and it was not confined to Acre alone. As Lieutenant Petit, the French United Nations observer, established, they did this in village after village to drive the Palestinians out of Palestine. They poisoned the Acre water supply, and in David Ben-Gurion's diaries, war diaries, there's the documentation of how this same introduction of malaria germs was used throughout Gaza. In Yerraham Cohen's book, In Daylight and Night Darkness, published in Tel Aviv in 1969, the documentation is replete with examples of the use of cholera, of typhus, of biological warfare, what is called bioterrorism and biocrimes, the illicit use of biological agents, a 220-page report on the deployment of biological agents to depopulate Palestine of its people.
And Thomas J. Hamilton, reporting in the New York Times, July 24th, 1948, talked about the use of the Zionists spreading cholera in Egypt and Syria in 1947 and 48. Again, to use bioterrorism to debilitate the Arab world. So these are documents that are now being released by the International Committee of the Red Cross, becoming available 50 years after the events, and the reference numbers for these reports are G59/1/GC and G3/82. And they were written May 6th through May 19th, 1948, by the ICRC representative in Palestine.
And the lesson here, brothers and sisters, is that weapons of mass destruction that target entire peoples are the instruments of imperial rule. It is the world wars, and in fact, the deaths of 86 million people in counter-revolutionary wars since World War II itself, which are defined by weapons of mass destruction. Here we have the Herald in Glasgow, October 14, 2001. The United Kingdom planned to wipe out Germany with anthrax, the Allies' World War II shame. And the Sunday Herald documents that Britain manufactured 5 million anthrax cattle cakes during the Second World War, with plans to drop them on Germany in 1944. The aim of Operation Vegetarian, as it was called, was to spread a bacterium through the human population amongst people, the civilian population of German cities, with no access to antibiotics, causing millions of deaths. And indeed, it goes beyond that. The American Heritage magazine has disclosed that Winston Churchill, in a July 1944 memo to his Chief of Staff, General Hastings Ismay, called for the, quote, drenching of Germany with poison gas. And the disclosed report states, "I want you to prepare seriously for the use of poison gas," the four-page memo from the wartime British leader continues. "It is absurd to consider any morality on this topic. We have seen the bombing of open cities in the last war," where he's speaking of World War One, "which was then considered to be something that should not be done. Now we do it as a matter of course. It is simply a question of fashion, changing as she does between long and short skirts for women." The Churchill directive was blunt. I want a cold-blooded calculation made as how we will use this poison gas. We will not be bound by silly conventions of the mind. We will drench the cities of the Ruhr and the other cities in Germany in such a way that most of the population will be wiped out. It may be weeks, it may be months before I ask you to drench Germany with poison gas. If we do it, we will do it 100%. In the meantime, I want this matter studied and prepared in cold blood and not by a set of psalm-singing defeatists, says Winston Churchill. The imperialists are relentless. The imperialists have no shame. The imperialists deploy weapons of mass destruction as a class war in their inter-imperial rivalries and their slaughter across national frontiers, the purpose of which is to sustain an exploitative rule and a degenerate economic and political order that requires mass murder as the linchpin of its continued existence on this planet.
We are the many, and they are the few, and they know it. The leaders of this onslaught have been marginalized. They cannot meet in their own capitals. They are off in a tiny island in the Azores, in the middle of the Atlantic. That is where they have to make their announcement, their threat on the world and their threat to other imperial powers. The world's crisis is the crisis of imperialism. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.
There are many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged. Those who can't afford good legal counsel. Those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the US, capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait, sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given, and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong, the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
HIV संक्रमितहरूलाई माया, ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरूको अपेक्षा होइन, अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौं, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरूलाई मात्र होइन, तपाईँलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
I'm gonna stand until I can't stand no more. If I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POCorganize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
My name is Gordon Hill from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation in Northwest Coast of so-called British Columbia, Canada, and you're listening to Radio Intelligent Indigenous.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Gigante.